This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good afternoon, good evening, America, good morning, Australia, good morning to the rest of the world, or whatever your time zone. You are tuned in to the People Speak radio show with Steve Johnson. The People Speak show normally airs every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific and 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS radio network. Anyone can participate during the show with call-in questions for our guests toll-free in the United States and Canada on 1-888-429-5471. That's right, Corpy, 1-888-429-5471. Or you can join us live in the government politics section of Pal Talk, the largest free chat program in the world, where we have a virtual radio room, the People Speak show, that anyone may join to participate in the show. We have a truly wonderful woman and a gifted author on the show today. I'm more excited than John Howard at a midget convention covered by an Ewok convention. She's a brave and courageous woman who has lived through some unspeakable hardships, suffered through the most awful state and church-sanctioned evil of the 1960s and 70s. She is one tough-as-nails Sheila. We are absolutely blessed to have an Australian icon here at the People Speak show. Welcome to the show, Kate Howarth, ma'am.
Thank you, Steve. I don't know about icon, but thank you very much. I'll try to live up to that. Good morning, everyone. Good morning to your listeners. Nice to be here.
Well, I see you as a penultimate Australian, somebody who speaks her mind and is not shy to do so. That to me, sums up the Australian spirit. Would you not agree?
I think that's pretty right, yeah.
Mm. We'll be talking about your second book today, the sequel, award-winning book to Hail Marys, 10 Hail Marys. We'll be taking audience questions after the first half hour, but my first question to you, Ani Kate, is how did you get started on the book? What prompted you to begin compiling all the memories and all your experiences into the most compelling, powerful book that it is today?
Well, I think I had one of the greatest motivators anyone can have for doing anything, and that's rage, white hot rage. When I realized in my 40s the injustice that had been suffered by young women who had their children taken at birth during the period that is now known as forced adoption practices, you know, I had literally had smoke coming out my ears. And I realized that was the first time in my life I realized how important my story was to tell. Because although I was an unwed mother through the 60s, I did fight the church, my family, society, and I actually kept the baby, which was very unusual. And when the parliamentary inquiry, the first one into adoption practices, was held, which was more than just a whitewash, in 1998, after I read that report, they said they were not able to take evidence from anyone who actually kept the baby of 150,000 girls that went through those homes in New South Wales, because that was initially just a New South Wales inquiry. And then I realised, as I read further on into the report, and I realised that financial support for us girls was always available but kept hidden. And that was the biggest weapon that they had to use against us. Of course, we were unmarried, we were abandoned by our families, most of us were broke, and we were desperate. And, of course, they said, well, how are you going to keep this child? You've got no means of support. So it was very, very easy to coerce young women to sign those consent for adoption when they felt that they would be going out into an unknown with no money, no support. And when I realised that that support was available all the time, well, I knew I had to write the story. And I wanted it to hit the ground running. It took me 5 years to write because I had to, first of all, teach myself to write. And I wanted it to be written by me, not a ghostwriter. So I had 1,000 and more rewrites. Writing, they say, is about rewriting, and that's for sure. And I wanted it to be a book that would not just sit on the shelf or wouldn't get any hearing. I wanted it to really make a splash because I really wanted it to put this topic on the front burner and get politicians interested, get people interested who could actually do something about it. And because all of the young women who lost their children, of course, they were traumatized into silence. They'd been labeled heartless sluts who didn't want their kids and just had to go off and get on with their lives, most of them not even knowing what the sex of the child was and never seeing or having held the child. It was a shocking, shocking time, Steve. So, I had rage is the simple answer. That's the long answer. Short answer is rage. Rage motivated me.
And it wasn't just a bit of pressure on you to give up your child. They resorted to all kind of tactics. After reading the book, I was kind of shocked. They tried blackmailing you, bribing you. They tried absolutely threatening you. What were some of the worst things that you faced to try and force you to give up your child?
Well, if you understand, we were in these homes, and although we weren't locked in, we were pregnant, and, you know, society didn't allow and didn't really assist pregnant girls. There were no support networks there, and we were shamed into keeping ourselves hidden. So you were virtually trapped in these places. You were working, you know, slave labour. You were working, you know, 8 hours a day, 6.5 days a week, and, you know, that the capacity for them to apply intimidation tactics was pretty high. You'd have to say that the tactics they used were tantamount to torture. There were a couple of days, you know, that really reached a peak. One of them was on Boxing Day 1965, and bearing in mind I'm still only 15 at that stage, I'm two weeks from my 16th birthday, I'm 8 months pregnant. I've been accused of being seen across the road at a pub, which was a slop shop. I mean, this hospital was in the red light district of Sydney. I had no idea where Darlinghurst was in those days, but that's where it was. And because I still hadn't signed the consent for adoption by Christmas, the hospital administrator cranked up the heat, and she was threatening to throw me out of the hospital if I didn't sign the consent. And I had a big showdown with her, and my Uncle Stan and my aunt were present. They were the only members of my family who came to see me. And Uncle Stan, of course, was a very devout Catholic, and I'm standing there virtually calling this nun a liar in so many words, and he was shocked and horrified. Anyway, she didn't buckle. I didn't sign the consent, and she was telling me, go pack your bags, you're leaving. And so I did, and I had no idea. I went and got my things out of the room and walked to the front of the hospital. I had no clue where I was. I had $20 in my pocket. And I'm looking left, looking right, thinking, which way do I go? Where do I go? And so that was pretty hard. Then, of course, they really cranked up the heat after my son was born, and I still hadn't signed the consent. Well, things just got harder and harder, and I'll leave the readers to read that. I mean, I think back now, I think, God, how did I ever survive that? How did I not go completely off my head? I'm not sure I didn't, to be honest, but it was a terrible amount of pressure to put a kid under, particularly a young mother.
Now, the feelings that I get when I read the first book, Ten Hail Marys, is that life in the early 60s and 70s in Australia, it was a system of rules and policies that really didn't care what effect those policies had on the individual. Do you see that still very much the same today in Australian government and politics?
It was more so then, I think, you know, bearing in mind back then, Steve, we still had the White Australia policy. We still had the Removal Act of Aboriginal children. Contraception wasn't available to women. Abortions were illegal. And if you did what I did, went through and kept the child, you were labelled a heartless bitch who, you know, thought more of herself than the child for not giving it up for adoption. So thing, you know, particularly for women and children, I mean, children didn't have a voice at all. You know, I back-chatted my grandmother one day and she just sent me to a home. She just got child welfare to take me away. Well, you read that. I spent a year in a home just for back-chatting my grandmother. They could do that. You see, I was a ward of the state and she could do that. She said, you know, you'll behave yourself or I'll send you away, and she did. So that was how powerless we were as kids. For women, it was, you know, pretty, we were chattels. You know, you've read the second book and you know that by 1977, I was 27 years old and I had to go and get consent from my first husband, whom I hadn't seen for 9 years. I had to go and get his consent to get a passport. So things were pretty heavily weighted against women back then and children. Yeah, it was a man's world.
Personally, why do you think it is so many people back then were deluded into thinking they were doing the right thing when, by today's standards, such attitudes are horrific? Why do you think it is that it was the done thing back then? Do you think people just didn't know any better?
I don't think they deluded them. I think that their ego was such. Families didn't want the shame of a... Bearing in mind, we were largely a white Christian community back then. That was predominantly the demographic. And to have a child out of wedlock, to have sex out of marriage, of course, was scorned, but of course everybody did that anyway. But to have a child out of wedlock and have what was called an illegitimate child, I mean, they were actually had no legal rights, these children. They were bastards. So there was a very definite stigma on the family who had a bastard child in the family. Not so much in my Aboriginal family, because we all were little black bastards were running around everywhere. But in the white Christian community, which is where I was sent to this home, it was scorned. And look, I was 15, Steve, and I knew that what they were doing was wrong, because I was coming from the place of a child. And from the place of a child who was raised on I spent a lot of time on a farm. I saw how, one of my uncles, he bred dogs, and the concern that he put into that mother not to whelp those pups too soon, don't go near her while she's feeding, all that sort of thing, an absolute profound respect for the mother, and not to take the pups away too soon because it will destroy the mother who's throwing the pups. So I understood this, and I thought, if that applies to a dog, why doesn't it apply to humans?
Yeah,
so I was a bit like the emperor's. I was a kid, you see. I wasn't an adult. I was only a young girl, 15. And I'm thinking, no, this is wrong. You're telling me it's not wrong. I know it's wrong.
Now, we live in 2015, and today, despite years and years of commissions and hearings and policy changes into forced adoption, do you think today, in 2015, that child protection policy often still gets so very wrong in many cases?
Well, I think the evidence says it does, to be honest. You know, look at the children today in this country, Steve, who have been killed in violence, in families. It's epidemic. But you know what? It always has been. It's just that the internet now and the way news gets out on our internet, we see it's more prevalent, it's more in our face. But it's always been a problem. And, yes, the services do get it wrong, I'd have to say, most of the time.
Wow. Now, being an Indigenous woman and a proud Indigenous woman, which is fantastic, I guess this question is aligned to you. How closely similar are the forced adoption policies of the 60s and 70s? How closely similar are they to the stolen generation policies of the years before?
They're worlds apart. The stolen generation, that was legal. That was the government who passed an act with the absolute express purpose of breeding out the black fella. That's in the law. That was legal to remove light-skinned Aboriginal kids, or half-caste, quarter-caste, or quadroons, and all the names they had for us. But they could literally just come into a family that they saw a light-coloured Aboriginal kid and just remove them, just take them, and take them right away from their family, right away from their community. And, of course, the younger they took the child, the least, and they would look for very young children. I can remember as young as 3 years of age having to run and hide under the house, or my granny, she had a big kitchen table and she put a tablecloth, she made it go right to the floor, and if a car pulled up at the front, she'd say, "Quick, Katie, get under there." And I'd have to sit there as quiet as a bloody mouse, trying not to breathe, while these people came in and inspected our house, because they could. The Aboriginal Protection Board could just come in, but they were actually looking for kids, light-skinned kids, and they'd take us away. Now, that's when we get to the forced adoption practices. They broke the laws. There was a Child Adoption Act of 1939, which clearly stated that you couldn't take consent before the child was born. You had to let the mother know of all of the options that were available, including the financial support that was available, and there was a 30-day revocation period when she could change her mind and the adoption would not go through. None of those points were told to any of the young mothers who went through those homes, and we're talking 350,000 young Australian girls when our population was only about 4 million, so it's a lot of girls and a lot of babies and a lot of families that were affected. And by not telling the young mothers of that help that was available, of course, they were able to procure these babies for what became a very rapacious adoption industry.
And they actually made a huge business out of that, selling babies. Is that not true?
Well, absolutely. It was a profit driven business, no doubt about that. They didn't just give healthy newborns away.
Now, the biggest question in my mind after reading 10 Hail Marys, the best-selling book, a winner of the Nonfiction Age Award, Book of the Year 2010, is how on earth did you keep your sanity through some of these stories that I read in this book? It seems like anybody, a lesser human being, would not have been able to take that. There were some dark passages in your life before you had your son Adam, and even darker times during your pregnancy. What kept you sane through it all? Was it your personal toughness?
No, I don't think it was my personal toughness. I think it was just an innate understanding that you have to try and keep yourself above it. You know, you have to try and keep your head above the water. And I guess that comes from, you know, when I learned to swim, I was literally thrown in the deep end by my eldest brother. And I remember going under and having to paddle all the way to the top. And if I could just keep my head above the water, I could get over to the edge of the pool. And so that was the analogy for me, just to keep my head above water and look for something to hang on to. And for me, always, from as young as I could put a pen to page, writing was one of my sources. And I used to, you know, write endless diaries. I'd write things down as they were happening, and then I'd go back over them and I'd look at them, and that just kept me grounded. And also music, although I didn't have an instrument as a child, I loved to sing. So I would sing in the dark if I felt frightened. I would find some way to, you know, just to find some happiness for myself. And that kept me going.
One amazing statement that you made in the book that really hit me and sums up your determination is a passage that you wrote saying, and I quote, "They can lock up my body, but my dreams belong to me." Do you think that sums up your determination and how you managed to live through all that?
Oh, most definitely. And when you realize that, if you are incarcerated, and we've seen that happen, you know, Papillon, those great movies you see where people, and you read about Nelson Mandela and people who've been incarcerated for many, many years under grueling, brutal conditions, they keep themselves together with their imagination. They keep themselves together with their mind. You know, the mind becomes the most powerful, beneficial. You know, you've got to try and hang on to that and hang on to yourself the best way you can.
Now, in the sequel called Settling Day, I noticed that one thing that distinguished this book from the first one is in the first book is all about growing up. In the second book, it seemed to me that you were finding the family life that you didn't have when you were growing up. Is that kind of true, that you were looking for that family life, the husband and the kids and everything that you wanted to live for?
Well, the second book is also about growing up, really, because I didn't get to grow up when I was a kid. You know, I missed my childhood, I missed my teens, and I go into adulthood without any of those formative years giving me the solid grounding that one usually gets if you come from a family where you've got good role models and you're guided through and you finish your schooling. All of those things were denied to me. So my journey was to, you know, I was constantly learning and constantly growing and having to nurture and mother myself. So, you know, the book isn't about, you know, the growing up doesn't stop at 10 Hail Marys, it continues. You know, right. my growth to finding myself, the growth to maturity. No, my drive wasn't so much, as you know, at the end of 10 Hail Marys, I'm 17, I'm homeless, penniless, I've lost the child I've fought so hard to keep, and I've got to go forward, you know, without a thing, without anything, with just a suitcase, a sewing machine and a few bucks in my pocket. And that was the starting point at 17. But the drive there was to get my son back. And I knew to do that, I had to improve my position. I had to get an education. I had to get into a good job. I had to work my way to a position where, if necessary, I was in a strong position to go and kick those doors down, if necessary, to get my son back. So I wasn't driven to marry and to have more children. In fact, I was not going to have more children. I would probably never have had another child if I hadn't had my son, if I hadn't brought my son back into my life. So I was driven for 14 years to do that, and 2 years after my son and I were reunited, I fell pregnant and had another child.
At one stage in Settling Day, in one section in the book, you visit a psychic and a handwriting analyst called Mr. Haig. How much did that visit and that influence from him, how much did that change your life?
Well, let me just tell you, Haig was not a psychic. In fact, he scoffed anything to do with psychic phenomenon. He was professional. No, he wasn't a psychic. He was a psychiatrist and a psychologist and a medical practitioner, but he certainly was a man of science. He wasn't a psychic. And when he was reading, analysing my handwriting, because he told me some extraordinary things, and I'd not met the man, and he did it all from samples of my handwriting when it was sent to him for, you know, an assessment by a firm I was working with, and they wanted to promote me to a very senior position. And they used to use Haig Masters and his wife, Josephine, as industrial psychologists and consultants to determine, you know, the suitability of people to take on these more senior roles. And particularly as I was a woman, and they've never had a woman in this particular job before, I had to agree to subject myself to this test. And when I finally got to meet Haig at his property out at Oakdale, which you read about, was most unusual sort of practice that he ran. He didn't have an office, and you walked around the bush. You sat on bush rocks, and you met this man. Was the most extraordinary human being I think I've ever met or likely to meet. And he started talking, and I said to him, you know, Haig, I can kind of read handwriting. You know, I get images when I see handwriting and I look at it. Is that psychic? Well, he nearly slapped me. He said, no, there's no such thing. He scoffed it completely. And he said, no, it's a science. He said, but what you're seeing, Kate, because you've had to learn to read people from a very early age, you have developed a very high, you have a highly developed intuitive skill. So that's what comes into play. When you're in the company of someone, you know, you're not actually reading their body language like a body language expert, but you just absorb a lot to do with that person. And he said, you're particularly attuned to someone's voice. You will never forget a voice once you hear it. And I tell you, that's true, Steve. After years, I can hear a voice from my past and I know exactly who it is. And he said, that's because you had to listen to your grandmother so intently, because she was so volatile, she was so unpredictable. You had to pick her mood from her voice. And so you developed and honed that skill very young. Anyway, Haig went on. I did study handwriting analysis with Haig and went on to introduce that or include that in my professional life some years later.
And I do believe that there was one guy that you did a handwriting analysis on. He turned out to be an absolute killer. Is that not true?
Well, there were many examples I could have put in there, but I put in one that I knew if anybody wanted to check it, through the news or through sources. You know, when you make a claim like that and you write it in a book, it's best to put something that you know can be checked. And so Angelo Angelides was the man's name, and I was given his application on the fly, really, and because he was being considered as the personal driver for the senior partner of one of the world's most, you know, prestigious accounting firms. So it was a pretty important job. And I got this, have a look at this. And I looked at it, and I said, oh, the man's an assassin. And I handed it back to the – I said, no, he's no good for the job. He's an assassin. And, of course, he stopped him in his tracks. He said, God, you can see that? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, he was in the secret police in Cyprus. I said, well, point, you know, I rest my case. Anyway, I said, oh, another thing about this fellow. I said, if he ever killed anyone and he was caught – he'd kill himself before he was brought to justice. Now, that was, you know, a few years later, I'm on a ferry with the same man. This man ended up being my husband eventually, and he handed me a newspaper. He said, have a look at that. And here was a story in the paper about Angelo Angelides, who killed his wife and then hung himself in his cell before he was sentenced. So that's why that was put in there. But I could give you many, many funny examples. I mean, I could write a whole book on the stuff that came out of a handwriting analysis, I could tell you.
Goodness me. And the company that you worked with, they weren't just an Australian company. They were, in fact, an international global business that you became a co-partner with. Is that not true?
Well, I didn't work with them. I became a director very quickly after joining the company, and the company was privately owned, and I became a co-owner and director within a year of joining the company. It was a franchise of the American group Manpower, and it was in its, you know, it was really not much of a company here at the time. They were doing mostly industrial work, and I was brought in to open up an office division for the company. And yes, it went on to become a leader in its field in Australia.
So how much of that has actually influenced your life since joining that company and realizing that you can reach your goals no matter how much you are told you can? Did that actually give you some kind of inspiration to keep going and going bigger?
No, I'd reached many goals, many milestones before I got to Manpower. You know, as I said, I'd started off at 17 with virtually no education beyond, you know, high school, or even didn't finish high school. So I had to didactically teach myself all of the things that equipped me to do that. One of them, of course, was accounting. I discovered things that I could do that took me into a male domain. I could learn through the library, and which I did. And I would apply for jobs in the accounting field, and then I worked my way up and I became a national sales manager. And then I worked for an employment company before I joined Manpower in Sydney. But I'd already climbed up the ladder by the time I got to, own and operate Manpower. So, and then it was just growing that business then. And of course, it was a very exciting time because it was the birth of office automation in the world and certainly in Australia. And as you know, Steve, because of our isolation down here, we just really grabbed office automation, and we became, you know, forerunners. And, you know, we couldn't get enough of it because we weren't so close. You know, Europe, we didn't have Europe on our doorstep. We had to fly, you know, 17 hours or so to get to the United States. And so we really embraced it. And when I went to the States in the late 1970s, and I saw these amazing things that they were calling IDDUs, interactive digital display units, which of course we now call PCs, I could see a huge future for it. And I thought, gee, we've really got to gear up to this. If we gear up to this, we will be a leader in the field within 5 years. And of course we did. And so that plan was put in place. And by 1985, we had the first word processing training centre ever to be introduced into Australia. And, you know, we had more than 3,500 temps out in the field in any one day. It became huge.
Wow. And I believe you instituted personally the idea of having somebody temporarily and then possibly hiring them for permanent if they were in there. What was that called? There was a special name for that.
Well, that was an innovation of mine called JobProve. Because we didn't do permanent placements, and I really didn't want to get into permanent placements because that was a commission-driven industry. It didn't require a lot of it. And these days it requires more, you know, very often university degrees before you'll go into a human resources management company these days. But back then it was a pretty tawdry sort of industry, and I really didn't have – I had only had disdain for it. But we had many, you know, situations where – the customer would say, I'll just name Citicorp for one. We would have, I don't know, 50 temps out in the field with Citicorp on any day, and most of those jobs were filling those jobs while some other company was waiting to employ someone full time, and then of course they'd find someone full time and realise that the full time person wasn't as good as the temp. So I thought, hang on a minute, we can solve this. We can put people in as a temp. Let them work there for 8 weeks. If they're happy, off you go. No fee. We get 8 weeks temporary work out of it. The person gets the applicant gets a job, and the customer gets someone who's been on the job and proven the job out. So it was called JobProve, and it was hugely successful.
Now, apart from the awards, how much of your books influenced Australian life? How much have they influenced the policies of Australian politics today?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. All I do know is that I don't know that they've influenced politics, but it was certainly instrumental in getting a Senate inquiry into adoption practices going. But I didn't do that single-handedly. There were other people involved as well, an organisation called Origin, whom I give full credit to. You know, they'd been working very hard on this and getting nowhere for a long time. They needed another boost, and my book gave it that boost. But, you know, it wasn't solely down to me, Steve. There were women who'd been in this fight for 10 years before I even had my book launched. My book was just an aid, if you like, to what they were already doing. And so, yes, it did change policies, and it did affect, you know, certainly there were apologies given, but it also changed policies. It changed the adoption practices, and you know, the laws were reviewed and instruments were put in place so this could never happen again.
Now, I feel that your book did influence politics. I think that it put a very, very human face on the problem of the 1970s that we had with the forced adoption practices. Do you think now, looking back, that that these things were just completely inhumane?
They were inhumane. There's no other way to view it. You know, what they did was just appalling, really, if you think about it. You don't even need to think about it, do you? Young girls get pregnant, they get banished from their families, they get put into institutions, they work, you know, in dreadful hours. You know, the girls who had actually signed the consent for adoption have got a better run at it than I did, of course, because I was being punished and they were trying to break my will. So I was given grueling work, longer hours. You know, I was really, they were trying to beat me into the ground. You know, if you'd given consent for adoption, you could sit in the first, in the private hospital polishing silver all day while I worked in the laundries and the kitchens.
Now, the conditions that you had in these particular homes in the St. Margaret's, I believe it was, that was almost like gulag conditions when I read it, that some of the fighting for scraps of bread and fighting for food and seeing moldy meat on the tables, that's really, really horrible compared to what we should expect from a place like that. Is that not true?
I don't think even Dickens could have written it. You know, it's worse than any Dickensian story you'd ever want to read. It was nightmarish. Yeah. Absolutely, it was anarchy. There was nobody overseeing us. It was dog eat dog. The accommodation was absolutely a hovel. It was the old nuns' quarters, and I remember having to scrub the cell. And it only was a cell that I was allocated. I had to get down on my hands and knees and scrub that room for about 2 hours before I felt I could unpack my suitcase. And wow. The food, again, we were 15-year-old kids. Most of the girls had never boiled an egg. They had no idea how to cook for themselves. And the food, the staple food was bread, eggs and cornflakes, which is highly unsuitable for young pregnant girls. And, of course, the eggs would constipate and the milk was, you know, I guess the milk was good, but, you know, cornflakes and eggs and white bread. Occasionally meat would be brought over and left on the bench in the summertime once, a big leg of lamb. It smelled great until you realise it was crawling with maggots. So that was the way it was. And nobody came to check on us. You know, you couldn't hang your clothing out on the line, or people would steal your underwear. And it just really was the most dreadful conditions that we were reduced to living under. Hmm.
And this was under the auspices of the Catholic Church, right?
Well, you know, I just can't blame the Catholic Church here. You know, everyone was out to lunch. The child welfare should have been looking in on us. The Department of Labor and Industry should have been taking a note that all and hundreds of girls were working in these hospitals, not just St. Margaret's, without pay, in appalling conditions, unsafe conditions in the kitchens and laundries. Everyone was out to lunch. Unfortunately, because the churches, the institutions, and I stress it wasn't just the Catholics, but the church-run institutions, nobody thought that to even inspect them. So they got away with whatever they wanted. And some were worse than others. St. Margaret's was probably at the worst end of the scale. But I've since met unmarried girls who were at other church institutions who weren't treated anywhere near as appallingly as we were at St. Margaret's. So it did vary from place to place.
Well, that's good to hear. This is the People Speak radio show. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, talking with special guest author Kate Howarth from Australia live on radio. And we'll be right back with our guest and audience questions after this short message break.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Today's school libraries are filled with endless opportunities. With access to print and digital materials, the latest technologies, and the guidance of a school librarian, our children are empowered with the tools they need to succeed in school and beyond. I'm Julianne Moore. Join me in celebrating all of the ways that school libraries and librarians are transforming learning for our students. For more information on how you can become involved, visit the American Association of School Librarians at aasl.org.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
You're listening to the People Who Speak radio show on the BBS Radio Network, coming to you live across America and across the world. I'm your host, Steve Johnson, and we're back tonight with our very special guest, Auntie Kate Howarth. Welcome back, dear ma'am.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, indeed, we do have a caller in. This is the People Who Speak radio show, and we get calls from all over the world. We have a guy who goes by the name of Corp Fascist coming to us live and direct from Ohio. Are you there, Corp?
I'm here.
Go ahead, sir, with your question to Auntie Kate Howarth.
Hi, Kate. It's always great to hear from you. I want to ask you this simple question. What is it that you want me to learn from what you've experienced in your life?
I don't think you can learn anything from my experience at all, Corp. I think all of your lessons have to come from your experience. All you could probably do, if you read my books, is perhaps be entertained, I would hope. If there is some connection in there in your life, that would be great. But at least I could guarantee you a rollicking good read, some laughs, bearing in mind it's R-rated, there's adult themes, sex scenes, violence, coarse language. It's all there, but I don't know that it'll teach you anything.
Well, thank you very much for your question there, Corp. Fantastic answer there, Auntie. You know, I think I did personally, I took something away from this, and that is no matter how much the struggle is, no matter how overwhelming the odds are against you, if you want to make it through and you believe in yourself, you will always do that. Do you think that's a good analogy?
Well, I think it's a good thing to have, but I don't think it does actually apply in real life to many people. Some people can have all the will, but the odds are so hopelessly stacked against them. You know, I have to say that I was very lucky on a number of occasions to meet people who put out their hand and I was able to grab it. I didn't do everything absolutely on my own, Steve. You know, there were people, and you read about them in the book, and I give them full credit for being there for me. And I think that that's important, you know, to be not to isolate yourself so much, not to think that you have to do it all yourself. Be prepared to take that hand up if you get it. You know, someone puts out their hand and says, look, please take my hand. I've never rejected that. And I've met some wonderful people who have, from a very young age, saw the potential in me. Haig Masters, of course, was one of them. He was pivotal to my going forward and doing what I did with my life. And other people like Olwen White that I mentioned, Peggy Levy. Yeah, there are a number of them that, and my uncle Stan, that there are a lot of people that, I have to say deserve recognition for my survival in some instances and also for having gone forward and enjoyed the life that I've been able to enjoy.
Mm. Now, interestingly, in the first book, Ten Hail Marys, there is a section there where you actually talk about experience a ghost of your pop. Is that true? Did you actually feel that there was a spirit of your deceased pop that was in the house?
Well, that's what I was told it was. Pop had died. I was there when Pop died, and it was the first person that actually died in front of me. I nearly set him on fire, incidentally, if you remember. I was packing his pipe, and he had a hairy chest, Pop, and it was a very hot day. And I packed his pipe, and he started to cough, and I didn't realize it was the death rattles. And I dropped the pipe and spilled it all over him, and his chest went up in flames, and so I nearly set him afire before he passed away. But sometime after he passed away, I'd lay in bed, and he had a very distinct sound. When he knocked a pipe out, he had a glass ashtray, and he'd give it three knocks, bang, 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 And then because he was an old man and his bedroom was just across the hall from the bathroom and it was like linoleum floors and he had leather-soled slippers, so you hear this as he shuffled to the bathroom. And a few weeks, I don't know, in terms of time, I can't remember now, but I remember lying in bed. I used to share a bed with my grandmother and I heard the tap, 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 and I listened and I heard the and I said, "No, Mama, can you hear that? Can you hear that?" And she just said very blasé, "Oh, yes, love." She said, "That's just Pop. Don't worry. He won't hurt you." So that's the way it went.
So you have a strong belief in the afterlife, that there are spirits around us that guide us?
I've had some experiences, Steve, which I can't deny. I can't explain them in scientific terms, but I have been left with an appreciation, if you like, that there is something more, that we do live beyond this earthly existence. And when I was putting those parts in the book, friends of mine, atheist friends of mine particularly, "You can't put that in the book. People think you're stark raving mad." And I said, "Well, look, it happened. And I've witnesses to it happening. So I'm not going to put it in the book because you think I'm a nutcase because you don't believe in these things." So, yeah, they're in there and they happened, and some of them were a catalyst, as you know, particularly Auntie Daphne. I couldn't possibly leave that out of the book because that was pivotal to finally being reunited with my son. So, yeah, those things actually happened.
Now, your book, 10 Hail Marys and Settling Day, are both available on Amazon for around $30-odd, and they are definitely worth a read, now, not just for the personal story, but for the things you experienced, the things you went through, and how you transformed yourself into a powerhouse of a woman. Now, is there one thing that stuck in your mind while you were writing the books about what you wanted to express to people, or you just wanted to tell your story?
Well, as I said, the first book was beyond just telling my story. I was a very reluctant memoirist. In fact, when I first saw the first mock-up of the cover, they had memoir on the front, and I flipped. I said, "It's not a memoir. Please don't. This is not about me." I didn't want the story to be about me, because the message that I was wanting to convey was the forced adoption practices, and it only became about me because I had to go back and explain how a young girl of 15 got the strength to stand up to church and family and all of the conditions of the day that dictated, really, that I surrender my child for adoption. And so that's how that part of the book came to be. And as you know, the book ends very abruptly and very sadly. There's no happy ending to 10 Hail Marys. It's bang, because that's how it was. And at the end of it, I did do an epilogue because I was completely drained when I wrote that book. It took everything out of me because I really wanted it to be what it turned out to be, an award winner, a bestseller. You know, it opened up an inquiry. It achieved everything and more. But the greatest thing that it achieved for me as a writer were people coming back to me and saying they really enjoyed it. They couldn't put it down. That's where I get my joy. My personal joy comes from knowing that the effort that I put into writing that book gave someone pleasure to read it.
For sure, yeah, and touched their hearts, no doubt. Now, I see in both books that you've written, there is a focus on injustice towards women. It followed on in Settling Day. It just continued on. Do you believe that things have changed in this respect through the years since you experienced those things?
There have been some significant changes, obviously. Women today in 2015 enjoy many more liberties generally than women of my era in the 1960s and earlier. The 1970s was a massive shift for women with the feminist movements and so on, and of course the unions who helped the feminist movements in the workplace and better conditions and equal pay and all of those sorts of things. There are still some things that are really way out of whack, and that is, you know, the violence against women is still in this country, Steve, it's still epidemic. I don't know why men feel so dispossessed in this country that they feel they need to knock the crap out of their wives, but they still do. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen the other way, but as you know, most of the cases and the women getting killed, you can't open up your computer without someone finding that they've been shot or stabbed or run over or hung or strangled or something by an angry partner. And that's something that I hope we can see fixed. And as you know, There are many women working, Rosie Beatty and others, and myself, and a raft of women and men who are trying to fix this social dysfunction in our country. But no, things are better for women, but it's something that we just have to keep working on, and you know, because it's a process.
We have a question from Mike in California. Do you believe spousal abuse is rampant in Australia, or is it just more widely publicized by the media?
No, it's rampant. Without question, it's rampant. It's an epidemic.
That's sad to hear.
It is, but it's reality.
Is there any politician that you would trust in Australia to do the right thing for the people?
Gosh. Yes, Rachel Seward, a Greens politician. She is the one that kicked off the Senate inquiry. It took a Greens politician to take notice. As I said, this incident, the forced adoption, had already been through a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry and had been completely whitewashed. So, if I had a problem, if I had an issue, a woman's issue, female, any sort of injustice issue, I'd take it to Rachel Seward, and I'm pretty sure I could get her attention.
One thing I found after reading both books is you get to a point in your life where you walk away with you build yourself up to having everything you want, and you get to a point where you just walk away with almost nothing. That seems to be a recurring theme. Have you noticed that at all when you were writing the book, that there's this thing of building up, and then suddenly having nothing?
Well, I wouldn't say I was reduced to having nothing, but compared to where I was, as you know, Steve, I went on to be a very wealthy woman living a life that most people only dream about. But in the fight for justice against people who had done the wrong thing in my business life, I was prepared to risk everything. As I said to a barrister, I'd rather live in a tent than live with the injustice. Well, I almost did get to living in a tent. But anyway, I don't regret that. I've never put money, I've never ever put wealth and position before my principles. I've never sacrificed my principles for those for wealth or position or gain. And I certainly haven't minded spending and investing what I've earned into, you know, fighting for that justice. And so the fact that I've been pulled back so many times, I've always had confidence in myself to go, you know, to pull myself out of it and go forward. Now, I won't have the wealth that I once had, but you know what? I came from nothing. I had absolutely nothing. I was flat-ass broke, Steve, when I was 17, and I went on to become a very wealthy woman. I'm not a very wealthy woman these days, but in terms of finances, but I consider myself a much wealthier woman and human being in the things that count more to me.
Now, one thing that made me laugh was your husband, Daryl. He's he knew a lot about life. He knew a lot about business, but he was naive in the ways of the world. Would that be a true statement?
I won't say that he knew a lot about life. Daryl had a very cloistered life. You know, he was 19. He'd been raised on a farm in England. He was a place that started out as a plumber. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Plumbing's a very honourable trade. When I met him, he was struggling. He was bankrupt. He had a shell of a company. And together, we were a great team. Unfortunately for me, I didn't realise that, you know, Daryl had an illness which caused him to secret things away. You know, I didn't put this in the book, and I'm really not obliged to talk about his illness in interviews because it's pertinent and private to him. So I'm not going to expose that, but there was a condition which I wasn't aware of throughout our marriage, which created a lot of problems for us, and put a secrecy there that was very difficult to work with. But no, we if you can imagine, Steve, we lived and worked together 24 hours a day, 365 days a week for 14 years. Now, I don't know of any other couple that I know that's done that. So, you know, when you look back at that, something was going to give, wasn't it? And it did.
Now, in the first book, 10 Hail Marys, with so many awful things that happened throughout the book, it was a small joy to me personally to read towards the end that you had so many people asking you for forgiveness at the end of the book. It was a beautiful thing. It touched my heart. Do you believe this book, the first book, is ultimately about closure? and that we all seek to right the wrongs over the years, despite all that went on in the past.
Look, I really don't understand this word closure. I don't. I don't think there's closure. I think you just learn to accept things. You learn to understand them. And if you come to understand them and you've got it in your heart to forgive, I think that's a good thing. I think forgiveness is really good for the person who's offering the forgiveness. But closure, no. Some things have happened in my life that I'll never have closure on them, but I've learned to live with it, learned to accept it, learned to go forward with my life. And but I just don't think you close, you know, you close. For instance, how do you love someone and lose them and get closure? It's always there, you know. You don't.
Right.
So you just, just something that you just have to keep going.
So in other words, you're seeking a balance between it all.
Well, you just have to accept life for what it is, you know. It's ups and it's downs, and just try and deal with those things, not wear them on your sleeve, not make them a, you know. I think, see, I'm the eternal optimist, you know. I'm the half glass full person, and I've needed to be. I've needed to be. If pessimism had ever gotten in my way, I would have been dragged under. I'd have hit drugs, hit grog. I'd have been a mess. So I've always looked to on the positive side of life rather than the negative. Not to say that I don't weigh things up and calculate things out. I do, and sometimes I can be quite impulsive, as you saw when you read my book. I can make some impulsive decisions, and they can sometimes be good and they can sometimes be not so good. And one thing I remember from Lewis Klein, a mentor of mine that I mentioned, who was one of the fantastic people in my life who really saw my potential, and he said to me very wisely one day, you know, Kate, success, and this, I've got to tell you, this man was one of Australia's most successful businessmen. He started Anthony Squire's Menswear. You know, he was a giant in industry. And he said to me, success in business success in life is determined by how many good decisions you make over how many bad decisions. So
right,
I had to learn not to beat myself up over the bad decisions. And I think when people beat themselves up over bad decisions, or even beat other people up over their bad decisions, they hold themselves back. Except that you'll make bad decisions and just get on with it. Try to make more good decisions.
The one thing that you've always had, when you've had nothing, it seems to me you've always had this Singer sewing machine that's been like a ball and chain to your leg, and it's always been with you. It's part of you. Do you still have that today?
If I could turn my camera on for you, right behind me now in my family room, I don't have a Singer anymore, I have a Janome. Right there on my table is the ubiquitous Nomi and the overlocker, which I had to get out this week. I'm going to Sydney this afternoon, and I promised my daughter-in-law that I would do some alterations for her. So I did them, and I did them while I was waiting for this show to come on. So, yes, it's always there. This move, I've said to my son, you know, darling, I hope this is the last time I pick up this, excuse the French, bloody sewing machine and walk out the door with it. But, I've got one more move to walk out the door with my sewing machine, and it's coming very soon. So it's always there.
It's always with you.
I've been able to make a living out of that sewing machine, Steve. I ran a bridal wear business, remember? It used to make bridal wear, and that came about quite by accident. So that sewing machine, that's made me some money in the past, so I'm quite happy to hang on to it.
And not only made you money, it's also given you credibility and reputation when people could see what you can actually do with that, the magic you could weave.
I don't know. I think you're pumping me up a bit here, but anyway, you know, sewing. Look, anything creative. I'm a creative person. Sewing's creative. It's an artistic thing to do, and I really enjoy it. And particularly making beautiful bridal. It started off making children's wear, really, and beautiful, fancy, you know, formal wear for children. A bridesmaid's dress, a flower girl's dress is what started it all. I had a bridal wear shop, and we had this massive society wedding, and the dressmaker who'd made the little girl's dress completely made a mess of it. And the bride was just beside herself, and I'd made the bridal gown, and she was just hysterical. It was Wednesday night. The wedding was Saturday, and I said, look, I'll do it. So I raced into town, and I was living up in Palm Beach at the time, so get to town wasn't that easy. I got the silk, got everything I needed, and I spent the next day, a couple of days, head down, tail up, and while this was going on, at this stage, I'd had the bridal wear shop for about 3 years. My partner didn't know I could sew a stitch. So when I said, I'll make it, she went, oop. And that was, of course, with the bridal dress. She saw the bridal gown and she realised that I could sew, but the child's dress was even more complex than the bridal gear. And just the detail and the lace and the work and everything that went with it and all the silk. And she thought, my God, you know, compared to the bridal dress, this is going to be quite a challenge. And so she was surprised I was prepared to take it on. But anyway, it turned out perfectly and everybody was happy. And from then on, of course, I was making a lot of dresses in the back room of the business. My partner was very happy about that.
Would it be fair to say that running your own business, doing the sewing that you did, that was probably in both books, that was probably the happiest part of your life? Would you say that would be true?
No, this is the happiest part of my life right now. The life I'm living right now is the happiest part of my life. Now, back then, that was, there was always turmoil back there, Steve. As you know, there was, you know, that I was working and doing whatever I could do to keep myself occupied, keep myself busy. As you know, by the time I opened the bridal wear shop, it was really a hobby. I didn't do it for the money. I didn't need the money. But I did it for the activity. My daughter was at school. I wanted to do something with my day, and also be available to be, you know, her primary caregiver, to take her to school, bring her home, spend the holidays with her, and so on. So I went into this business with a friend, and it went from there. So, but no, I was still going through all the turmoil. As you know, I left the marriage. I had cervical cancer, so I had to take it very easy and concentrate on my health. That was a primary. So, no, there was still a big cloud over me in those days as to whether I was even going to survive. My health was going to hold. So, no, I wouldn't say it was the happiest time of my life, not by a long shot.
Right, right. We've got a final question for you, Aunty Kate, as we wrap up this interview. Do you support the Stop Funding of Israel?
Yes, most definitely. I would support anything that stops enabling people to oppress others.
Wow. So anywhere in the world where there's bullies, you want to see that stopped?
Absolutely.
That's
Why
very,
not?
Very noble. Very
don't
noble.
You? Don't you, Steve? You stand to see.
I have a passion. I have a personal passion for that. So, yeah, I got to agree with it. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Aunty Kate Howarth. It's been fantastic.
It's been great fun. Thanks for thanks for the time you had to take to read the book, Steve. You obviously understood it and all the little nuances in there, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed the interview. Thank you.
Absolutely. I love both the books, and I encourage anyone to go to Amazon.com and check out Kate Howarth, Australian author and Indigenous lady who is absolutely, you are an Australian icon, no doubt about that. And I want to thank you once again for your time and hope to see you one day as a host on the People Speak show, if possible.
Well, I will be a host on the show at the end of November. As you know, I'm coming back to interview Rabbi Rosen.
Awesome. Awesome. I can't wait for that. Excellent. Oh, thank you very much, Aunty Kate.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye for now.
You're listening to the People Speak show with special guest author Kate Howarth. I'd like to remind all the listeners to look out for her books on Amazon titled Settling Day and 10 Hail Marys. Join us coming up on the People Speak show soon when I talk to David Ray Griffin and other important hosts and guests from all around the world. Stay tuned for those interviews coming soon. Big thanks go out to the producers Mike, Donald, and Doug, and to all my friends throughout the world, to all the guys who give me so much support. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Hope you enjoyed the show just as much as I did. You can tune into my own channel on YouTube called Stop Funding Israel. But for me for now, take care and bye until next time.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people and they stood there hungry. And I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.